Hi, guys.
Hey, Stephanie.
Welcome.
Oh, I feel like I fucked that up.
No.
I jumped up.
Don't.
I got too excited.
You are Stephanie. I am Tux Lurzel. And that's Stephanie Domingo.
Yes. Tis
hi.
When I was a kid at school, learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
Welcome to Beyond Reproach.
Yes.
We're having an especially autumnal episode here for the beginning of October. Obviously, you know this, but just in case you forgot, we don't tell each other the stories that we're doing in advance.
Yeah.
But we do send them off to Tim, the pod father, just to make sure that we're not going to be talking about anything that he's going to have to cut later because it's like extraneous.
Yeah.
And because Stephanie and I both love extraneous detail.
We do. It's my favorite.
And Tim was like, this episode is coming out at the beginning of October, and these are both sort of like Halloween-y feeling stories.
Yeah.
Which is weird. We never do this on purpose,
no.
But it just always works out that
it's
we're like,
so weird.
Yeah. I think the stories themselves are complete polar opposites.
Yeah.
But both of them have a weird Halloween-y.
We are strangely in sync.
Yeah.
I recently had a birthday party. I, Stephanie Domingo, love to celebrate a birthday.
Mm-hmm.
I have been known to bake my own birthday cake and just throw my own parties. And
Tux, hashtag same.
Yeah. Tux hosted me, and we both independently of each other bought these cute little cone hats.
Like little ones for like baby
for
chickens.
Yes,
like they're like so small.
Smaller than a dog's head.
Yeah. Like, you know the size of a normal, those like paper cone party hats that you can get at like whatever, the dollar store.
Yeah.
These are like half that size.
Yeah.
But Stephanie and I both bought tiny sized ones.
Yes, without knowing. So weird, but I love it.
And I baked Stephanie's cake this time. She didn't have to bake her own.
Oh, strawberry lemonade. I love lemon anything. It was just, it looked like Candyland exploded on my cake. It was so pretty, so decorative.
Maybe I'll put a picture of it on our Instagram,
but
you should check it out. It's on my blog.
It had jewelry on it.
Yeah,
it had
like it's a little bling.
Little balls. Oh, so pretty.
And lemon heads.
My favorite. Lemon heads were my favorite candy growing up.
But so here we are.
Yes.
A very special Halloween episode of Beyond Reproach.
Yeah. Weird.
As per usual, we be drinking and we be swearing.
Sure do.
If you forgot, Beyond Reproach is the show about political scandals and scandalousness in American government and politics. We should cheers.
Yes. Let's,
we're about to do this. Ooh, did you hear that? That's the sound of a mug. Today we're drinking a cocktail out of a mug because we went for a very autumnal cocktail. I'm going to let Stephanie take a sip and see what she thinks.
Wow. Okay.
Today we're drinking what's called an ale flip.
Hmm. It's really good.
It's so good.
Wow. I don't know what I was expecting.
There's no coffee in it, but it almost tastes like you're drinking a latte. A flip was very popular during the colonial era, and well before America was America, when we were just a collection of colonies. It's essentially a hot, it's hot beer mixed with another spirit to make it stronger, and it has some extra jazz in it, but it feels
it's
very
really good.
Yeah,
it's very got spicy
nutmeg on top. Yeah, let me get into the
flavors go really well together.
I was very careful about which beer I chose to make sure that it tasted like it all worked together. So Flip first appeared sometime around the 1960s. 1690s.
There we go.
Yes. Flip first appeared sometime around the 1690s, and it was wildly popular in colonial America and stayed super popular for about another century.
Okay.
So through the end of the 1700s.
Mm.
The English considered Flip a lowly sailor's drink.
Oh, they would.
But Americans loved it, and George Washington was said to be a big fan of a flip. So Flip is, I sort of started to mention before, but Flip is basically a blend of beer. Usually you use a dark beer, like a brown ale. You don't want anything too bitter. Like you wouldn't use an IPA because it's way too hoppy. You want something kind of sweet and nutty. And then you mix it with either rum or brandy, and then a sweetener. And the sweetener would depend on the region, but the most popular one was molasses, which is what we're drinking.
What else would they use, like honey?
Sorghum was popular. I didn't see anything about honey, but I guess you could use honey. Sorghum was popular, maple syrup.
Oh, yeah.
And some places use dried pumpkin to sweeten it. I don't know if they would like grind it up first or
This is like OG pumpkin spice.
Seriously, yes. Colonial pumpkin spice.
For the basics back then.
Yeah, yes. Ye old basic bitches. Eggs were later added to give the drink kind of a velvety, creamy texture.
Yeah, it's very
and
creamy.
So this has egg in it as well. And then it would always be garnished with a little grated nutmeg. And you guys have already heard about how I have fresh nutmegs and a nutmeg grater at home.
He fancy.
So obviously refrigeration was not a thing yet in colonial America. So most cocktails were served either room temperature or warm. This one is obviously warm. It is like drinking a pumpkin spice latte,
yeah,
but with no coffee or pumpkin. Flip would be made traditionally in a pub or whatever.
You mean a tavern?
A tavern. Yes, not a pub. The English wouldn't drink this.
No,
they
wouldn't.
A tavern.
They wouldn't sully themselves.
Yes. They would take a big metal pitcher, combine the beer, the rum, the egg, the molasses, put it all together, and then they would use what was called a flip dog, which essentially was like a metal poker straight from the fire. So it'd be like red hot. And then they would just kind of like stir it real fast and froth it up. So it has like sort of a frothy texture on top. Obviously now I made it on the stovetop.
Yeah, it's molassesy, but not too molassesy. I was worried that I was going to have like a triggering vomit instinct because I was made to drink bootstrap molasses.
Blackstrap. Yeah.
Yes.
But blackstrap molasses and cooking molasses are two very different things.
Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah.
What I was
My mom accidentally bought blackstrap molasses once and was going to make like molasses cookies with it. And I was like, Mom, no, you can't use blackstrap to cook with. They're going to taste like salty and sour.
Very sour. The worst. My dad would mix it into warm milk when we were sick. Oof. And it was so terrible. But even more terrible was waiting to drink it, because then it would have that like gross skin on top.
Oh,
when
gross.
Milk cools, it would be like peeling off American cheese like that on top. Yeah, so it's like you're sick and you have to drink this thing that's like congealed at the top. And we couldn't leave the table until we drank it.
I do like to taste test things in advance just to make sure that I have like the ratios right, especially when you're making a recipe that's this old.
Yeah.
Things are pretty
weird.
Vague.
Like when you've never made anything like this before.
Yeah, I mean,
because why would you?
I would guess that 100% of our listeners today have never even heard of a flip. And if they have heard of it, they've never had it. It's super weird, but it's really good.
It's good. I'm going to drink mine.
Brown beer. I'm not even really a big beer person, but this is good. I found this beer by Rogue in Oregon. It's called like Hazelnut Nectar or something, but it's like a nut brown ale. And apparently American style brown ale is much more bitter and hoppy than English style, because Americans love hops.
Okay.
So if you're going to make this yourself, don't use American brown ale, use English style. There's English style brown ales that are made in
the
U.S.
Here. Yeah.
But just don't use an American style because it'll be bitter. So the cocktail is heated up in this pitcher with the flip dog and then would be served in a ceramic mug or a flip glass. But we're drinking out of fancy glazed ceramic mugs.
Yeah, 20 ounces.
Yeah, it's a big drink.
It's very big.
They would also sometimes pour them back and forth between the pitcher and the mug to froth it up even more.
Yeah, aerate it a bit.
This gave the cocktail the nickname a yard of flannel. Because it's sort of this flannelly brown color. And then as they were pouring it, it was said to be a yard of flannel.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So our modern, like, trick bartenders doing, like, a
show. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Flip also goes by the name Bellostop, Hotchpot, or Crambamble.
Yes. I prefer Crambamble.
Yes. So today we will be drinking some Crambamble.
Yes.
Halloween-y Crambamble.
It is delicious. That is a mouthful.
Yeah.
It is very, very yummy. I was worried, but it's tasty.
It's like drinking a latte. Because it's warm it's brown.
And it's frothy, too.
Yeah.
It's nutty. Like, I'm tasting the nuttiness and the molasses. Not so much. Well, yeah, there's a beer aftertaste.
I've said this before in the show that, like, we're looking for recipes that are, like, what? 200 years old, 300 years old.
Yeah.
This is essentially a 300-year-old recipe.
Crazy.
And every time I'm waiting for a cocktail that's gross,
yeah,
I'm convinced that cocktails fall out of fashion because they're not good,
yeah,
or not suited to modern tastes. Mm-hmm. And there's only been one cocktail that Stephanie and I both didn't really enjoy. And it was a more modern drink. Yeah. It was, well, we'll just admit it. It was the Dirty Martini from last episode.
A cocktail that we both loved.
We both did love when we were in college, yeah. And it's not good.
It was hard to drink. it felt like punishment in a way.
Yeah, this is a behind-the-scenes detail you weren't supposed to know, but we did not drink Dirty Martinis for the second part of the show. We switched to something else.
We couldn't. We couldn't do it.
But this is
good.
Everything I was reading described it as earthy, and it is kind of earthy.
Yeah, I can see that.
I was just expecting it to taste like dirt.
Oh, like, yeah.
I was like, this is going to be real gross, but it's just going to put us in this sort of colonial mood, but it's not going to be good. But it's good.
It's very good. There's an egg in it, a full egg. Mm-hmm. So it's not a cocktail that you can really drink more of, but I plan to enjoy this one.
Yeah. I will make this again. Who knew?
A drink that's perfect for the fall.
Yeah.
If you want to get real fancy with it.
Yeah. If you're a drinker that also is a ye old basic batch. You may need to try a colonial hot ale flip.
You mean a cram bamble or a flip.
Yes, yes.
So my story today is of the colonial era.
Ooh.
Do you know who Patrick Henry is?
Patrick Henry. I think I went to high school with him.
Yes, you did. He did. He was the dude who made history with seven little words. Give me liberty or give me death.
Ooh.
Yes. Henry, in the minds of many, stands as a rebellious patriot who urged the colonies to throw off the shackles of British rule. Some also know him as Virginia's first governor.
Hmm.
Few people know that this motherfucker locked his depressed wife in their basement until her untimely death.
What? Oh my God.
Fewer still know that this house where this all took place is a historical site of paranormal activity because of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ooh. Let me take a sip of my cram bamble.
Yes. Crazy, right? So the short life and the unfortunate demise of Sarah Shelton Henry is the topic of my scandal this episode. Hopefully, this is my first and last historical political scandal ghost story.
No, keep going. I want more.
I did and I didn't want to do this story. I've researched many problematic things. And this is the only story so far that has made me take a sabbatical, want to resign from the internet. You'll hear why at the end. So first things first, Patrick Henry, a brief history of the man before I jump into the wife he locked in the cellar.
Jesus.
Patrick Henry was born May 29th, 1736 at the Studley Plantation in Hanover County, Virginia. He was the second of 11 kids. And came from scholarly roots on both sides of his family. By age 10, his parents concluded that he was far too lazy to become a farmer and attempted to...
Same.
Also same. Yeah, no judgment. So they attempted to steer him towards academia. However, it seems the young Patrick was not inclined to book learning either.
Hmm.
He made little progress at school, and his father labored for 5 years to teach him Latin, Greek, and math with very, very limited success.
You're like, you're lazy, so let's learn Latin, Greek, and what else?
Math.
All lazy people study Latin and Greek.
I think it was like a physical laziness. Like, he was not going to be in the fields all day because he's like, likes to lounge.
Okay.
So it's like, maybe he'll lounge with a book.
That sounds like a good time to me.
So trying a new route, when Patrick was 16, his father set him and his brother up in a store. The business soon failed. At the age of 18, Patrick married Sarah Shelton, who this story will be about. Her dowry consisted of her 600-acre tobacco farm in Hanover County named Pine Slash, a house, and six enslaved people. Patrick's attempts at agriculture were also a failure. Riddle me this. How do you fail when you have other people working for you for free?
Seriously.
That's how bad of a farmer he was. Terrible.
Terrible.
So further bad luck followed 5 years later when the house and its furnishings were destroyed by fire. Oof. Patrick sold the only property he had left, his enslaved, and with the capital, he opened yet another store. Big surprise, this business was also short-lived.
Jesus, man, get it together.
Yeah. So his general ineptitude forced the Henry family, and by this time, the Henrys had two small children, to move in with Sarah's father in 1760. Patrick helped his father-in-law run the Hanover Tavern across the street from the county courthouse. He would observe the court's proceedings, and soon he became fascinated with the legal profession. He decided to become a lawyer.
Okay.
And surprisingly, he was an immediate success.
Weird.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what brought about this amazing reversal of fortune, you ask, probably?
Yeah.
He did not dress or act like an aristocrat, so that helped him. He was often found in the tavern entertaining people with his fiddle playing.
Ooh.
So he was popular with the and trusted by the common man.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. If you can get people on your side, it helps.
People love a politician that looks like they can have a beer with, a crambamble with.
Exactly.
Yes. I could have a crambamble with this guy.
He looks like the type that you could have a crambamble with. Second, while he may not have known the law as well as other attorneys, because duh,
yeah.
He is who he is, he did have a knack for swaying juries. His
okay.
speaking style was a departure from the traditional boring, dry legal oratory. Instead, he spoke like an evangelical preacher, using biblical references and appealing to passion and emotion rather than reason.
Boy, yes, that'll do it.
That did it. Henry became a prominent radical leader in Virginia and famous throughout the colonies. He was the focal point of Virginia's opposition to British policy. It is said that his Stamp Act resolutions were the first shots fired in the Revolution.
Wow.
Do you know about the Stamp Act?
No.
So it required the colonies to buy paper from the British,
okay.
and it was taxed. So all legal documents, all licenses, all marriage certificates, even newspapers and playing cards were taxed.
Wow.
And you had to pay pounds, not like colonies' currency.
Okay.
It really grinded people's gears. So he spoke out against that. Henry was elected to the first Continental Congress in August of 1774. At its opening, he put himself into a leadership position when he declared, "I'm not a Virginian, I'm an American." So he sat on several important committees and led the fight against the reconciliation plan with the British. And his leadership was actually crucial in defeating this plan, which only failed by one vote.
Wow.
Because people wanted to get back with the British because they were just afraid. So.
Sure. I mean, change is hard.
Yeah, exactly.
I get it.
So Henry returned home later that year and called a meeting to organize the militia in Hanover County of all able-bodied men over the age of 18. Patrick, who thought that war was inevitable, presented resolutions for arming the Virginia militia. The more conservative members strongly opposed these measures as premature, whereupon Henry supported the resolutions with his famous "Give me liberty or give me death" speech. When Patrick Henry gave this famous speech, few people knew that his wife, Sarah, had the devil in her head and had been locked in his cellar for the previous 3 years.
Jesus, already.
Three years. Yes. So I heard about this story in passing, and I was so eager to research it because I'm quite fond of the bullshit, especially heteronormative male bullshit. It's kind of like, it's what gets me excited.
Specialité.
I mean, it's just everywhere, so it's just fun.
Mm-hmm.
There's just lots of parallels to today. But little did I know where this story would lead me. For starters, Sarah, since she's a woman, there's just very, very little details about her early life, even though her family was really, really well off, really wealthy. We don't even know what day she was born. All we have is an estimated year of her birth, 1738. Sarah Shelton was born and raised in a 13-room farmhouse near Mechanicsville, Virginia, on land originally given as a handout to her grandfather, who was some fancy man. He was the first John Shelton of Norfolk, England. So he was given this land in the 1670s.
So he was given land as a handout just because he was like a
wealthy person. And,
yeah. Okay.
Like that's how a lot of people got their land. They're just like had land in England and like you just get free shit when you have shit already.
Okay.
So they were given this land and they moved over here. Her father, John Shelton II, ran a plantation and owned a tavern on his land. Patrick and Sarah were childhood sweethearts. They married in 1754 at a really young age, even by 18th century American standards. He was 18 and she was only 16. A year later, they had their first kiddo and four more would follow. When her husband's legal career took off, they bought one of the most imposing mansions in colonial America. It was a bit of a flex. They bought a 10,000-acre plantation called Scotchtown.
10,000 acres. What the fuck do you need 10,000 acres for if you can't farm, if you can't make money from agriculture.
You got the money, you want to flex on them hoes and show them that you're, you know.
Oh, Jesus. Yes. Okay.
So he bought this in Ashland, Virginia. So he was nouveau riche and very proud of it.
Mm-hmm.
He epitomized the class that would replace the Brits.
Oh, gosh.
Yes, hey, exactly. A twice failed shopkeeper and tobacco farmer, he remade himself as a circuit riding lawyer and talked his way up to the top, venting rebellious thoughts that other patriots were unable or unwilling to say. Sound familiar?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
While Henry galloped between courthouses and political assemblies, Sarah ran the plantation and raised the children. In 1772, just months after the Henrys moved into their new sprawling estate, then 32-year-old Sarah gave birth to their sixth child, their son Edward. They called him Nettie.
As you do.
Shortly after giving birth, Sarah began exhibiting signs of mental illness. She, quote, lost her reason, as folks put it back then. First, there was the melancholy. Then there was the violence. Sarah's mother wrote a letter to Patrick Henry's sister that read, quote, we feel Sarah is losing her mind after the birth of little Nettie. There is little information about the specific nature of Sarah's illness. Some sources point to an infection during childbirth as the cause of her disturbance. Most sources say that she probably suffered from a condition known as puerperal psychosis. It's a rare illness that can happen after childbirth.
Okay.
It's like the more severe version of postpartum depression.
Sure, okay.
There's a lot of terrible symptoms like mania, confusion, loss of inhibition, paranoia, hallucinations, and delusions.
Wow.
It's bad. The most severe of the symptoms lasts anywhere between 2 and 12 weeks.
Oh.
There's no information suggesting that Sarah participated in any of these decisions about her treatment, but recovery can take anywhere from 6 months to a year,
mm-hmm,
if properly treated.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Do you think her condition was
absolutely
properly
not
treated? Okay. So with six kids to care for, Patrick had to make a difficult decision. Mental illness was understood very differently then. Generally, it was viewed as sinful and criminal.
Yeah,
I mean, sign of the devil.
We were doing lobotomies in the early 1900s.
Yes, exactly.
So like in the 1760s?
Yeah.
Jesus.
A new hospital had opened in Williamsburg, Virginia, specifically to treat the mentally ill. It served as an alternative to prison and other punishments because they would just put crazy people in prison.
They just didn't know what the fuck to do with them. So they're like
trying to get them off the street. Yeah. So they locked them up.
Oh boy.
The treatments were harsh, but they were common for the times. Patients were bled. They were blistered. They were subject to pain, shock, terror. Henry thought that the facilities were more like a prison than a hospital. So despite recommendations, he refused to place her in the asylum's, quote, care.
You almost said hashtag
care. I did say hashtag care. Wow. It's 2019.
Yeah.
And it's hashtag sad.
Sad.
So he refused to place her in there. Instead, Sarah would remain home at Scotchtown in the, quote, care of the people who loved her.
Mm-hmm.
Who are these people who loved and cared for her? It really, really was a team effort. It was Patrick plus an unnamed slave woman, it seems. I mean, it was something.
Yeah.
So Henry had her confined to a room in the basement. According to accounts, she was emotionally very unsettled and became violent at times to the point that she had to be restrained by a straight dress, which is an early version
dress
of a straight jacket. Yeah.
Elegant.
It wasn't.
An elegant straight jacket.
There might be pictures of Tux on Instagram later.
In a straight dress?
In a very elegant straight dress.
Yeah. I feel like that's going to be like soon, like Gucci is going to be making straight dresses.
Terrible. So she was confined in this dress to prevent her from harming herself or others. She was attended to by a slave woman 24 hours a day. Each day, Henry would open a trap door to the basement and went down to feed her himself. The son of Sarah's doctor later wrote that while Henry was fomenting rebellion and arousing native people to his cause, calling them to arms, quote, his soul was bowed down and bleeding under the heaviest sorrows and personal distress. Okay. Which is probably true.
It's gotta suck. There's no real medical science as far as understanding mental illness at this point in history.
Yeah, they didn't think it was an illness. They didn't think that you can get better. They just thought it was like the devil.
Yeah.
It was an infliction.
That sucks.
His side of the family and popular biographers like to highlight the fact that he did what he did out of love for his wife and point out how he refused to put her in an insane asylum because of its horrors. And it was horrible. These facilities were really, really terrible.
Yeah, I'm sure that it was probably 100 times better than the treatment she would have received in an asylum.
Yeah. Her side of the family echoes similar sentiments, but speculate that Patrick's motivations might not have been 100% pure, as few are. They reason he may have also kept his wife caged in the basement to further his political aims.
Okay.
The stigma surrounding mental health issues are bad now, so I shudder to think what they were like 300 years ago.
Yeah. That's different than, like, I thought you were going to say, like, his family was like, well, he just wanted all of her, like, money and her land and whatever, so.
He did get all of that.
Yeah. But he would have gotten it anyway, so he's locking her away just because it's a dirty little secret that he doesn't want people to hear about, which is less, like, deplorable than just being like, I'm going to lock you away and
people steal your money. Dead. Yeah. Yeah. Despite his discretion, word spread quickly around the large plantation about the mistress's condition. In colonial America, people who suffered from mental illnesses were completely misunderstood. People didn't view it as a disease to be treated, but instead they saw it as being possessed by evil spirits. So this probably played a role, some role at least, in Patrick's desire to keep Sarah's illness a secret. As word spread around the plantation, many servants, enslaved people, and workers refused to come near the mansion, let alone enter it. So Sarah died in the spring of 1775, just three-ish years later. Again, similar to her birth, we do not have a precise date for her death or cause of her death, other than her death happened sometime in the spring before the middle of March when he gave his famous speech.
3 years after her last son was born.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. She was buried, they think, in an unmarked grave on the plantation. It was the custom at the time to bury, quote, the afflicted in total secrecy. This was a ritual, again, connected to the belief that the mentally ill were possessed by demons. So if you didn't know where the demons was, like, they wouldn't haunt you, basically.
Yeah.
So it would always be an unmarked grave.
The logic there is questionable.
Right?
If you believe in ghosts and
shouldn't you be
spirits,
highlighting that there's a ghost here?
Yeah, like,
buried?
Keep that shit.
Yeah.
But bury it far away so that it doesn't haunt you. Don't bury it, like, randomly somewhere so people don't know.
Yeah, I don't understand
it. I guess out of sight, out of mind.
To this day, the location of Sarah's final resting place is not known, but it is believed that her grave is 30 feet from the cellar door, or so says Wikipedia.
30 feet.
Yeah, which is so random. That's what Wikipedia says.
That doesn't sound right.
Right?
He's got 10,000 acres, but he buries her 30 feet from the house.
Yeah, that's so nonsense. But let the record reflect that her Wikipedia is only 305 words, excluding headings.
Yeah.
And Laddie Boy, President Harding's dog, is 368 words.
Wow.
So, yeah. Grief-stricken, Henry pulled himself together to make his famous speech March 23rd. 1775 in Richmond. After his wife died of who knows what, who knows when, Patrick spent increasing amounts of time away from Scotchtown. Mm-hmm. In 1777, when Patrick Henry was elected the first governor of Virginia and he remarried, he sold Scotchtown because it held too many bad memories of him.
I mean, that sucks. Like,
yeah, I wouldn't keep it either. But it seems, so says the internet, that Sarah's ghost remained. Like many great estate homes, Scotchtown did not fare well over time. It deteriorated and was eventually abandoned to squatters. In 1958, it was purchased by the Preservation Association and restored to its original glory.
Virginia, you said?
Virginia, yeah.
I'm like, I want to go there.
Yeah.
I'm going to walk 30 feet from the cellar door.
So most reports of the ghostly phenomenon at the house have taken place since the restoration. However, there are several accounts that precede it. It is reported that Patrick Henry's own great-great-granddaughter was convinced the house was haunted and refused to spend a night in it. Mary Adams, who's just a woman who lived at Scotchtown from 1933 to 1940, said that she heard unusual noises frequently. Once she and a group of children saw a ghostly woman in a long white flowing gown inside the house. The figure disappeared in front of them.
A long flowing straight dress.
Yes. Passerbys have seen lit candles in the windows when the house is dark, and also the images of a person holding a lit candle. Motion detection alarms go off inexplicably. The eyes of the painting of Joseph Shelton seem to follow people as they move.
Baloney.
Okay, yeah. I'm like, let the record reflect my eyes have rolled out of my head onto the floor. So there was more information on the ghosts portion of this story than Sarah herself, which is why I really thought about scrapping this story. I'm just like, this is all so silly. But it's, I don't know.
I mean, the ghost is another point altogether, yeah. But like, I feel bad for the guy. Like, this, yeah. His wife.
Yeah.
He clearly did like his, you yeah. know, love his
he
wife.
His
and
wife.
They had
yeah.
a good life until yeah. things yeah. went wrong.
Until she and got then, sick and he didn't really know how to handle it.
I mean, 3 years is a long time to be trapped in a basement
yeah.
and off your fucking rocker.
Yeah. No light down there.
Yeah.
And,
it's good that she didn't last any longer than that, though.
Yeah.
He was able to
yeah.
move on.
Much of the haunting activity centers around the basement rooms where Sarah was confined and where she died. They say paint will not adhere to the walls.
Because it's a basement, so the walls are yeah. probably damp.
Yeah. Or haunted.
Ooh. Ooh.
Visitors report sensations of an invisible presence. A tour group once heard shrill screaming in the basement.
Shrill.
Yeah.
Sounds... Must be a woman.
Yeah, right? She's probably on her period.
I almost just spat my cram bamble yeah. all over the place.
Oh, that would have been a shame. In the attic, sounds of chains dragging across the floor have been heard, and strange swarms of wasps and flies have collected at one window.
That's what happens when you have a house in the country.
So when I started this scandal, I did not know anything about this supposed paranormal activity, because why would I? And I wouldn't have picked this story.
Oh.
I fancied myself doing real research, despite the limited information I found. That was until I stumbled upon an account of a spooky visit to Scotchtown by a man named Patrick Henry Jolly.
Jolly
is a descendant of Patrick Henry. He is, per his website, both a fifth and sixth generation great-grandson of the American patriot Patrick Henry and his first wife, Sarah. His site is a long series of unironically flattering accounts in blog form of Henry's role in history. Side note, he sometimes portrays Patrick in reenactments when he's not working as a clown.
Oh.
Banjo the clown is what he goes.
So that's scary.
Yes. When he's not chatting in forums talking about the New World Order.
Oh.
After reading about his spooky visit and doing a little Googling about him, I went into a really deep rabbit hole that necessitated a 2-week break from internet research. After I learned, wait for it, he's from Ohio. It was all too much.
Why am I not surprised?
So the purpose of his blog, he says, is to, quote, help us get to know more about the man who typically only is remembered by 7 words, give me liberty or give me death. So despite our differences, we are united in that goal, but I wanted to center my story, of course, on Sarah. So without evidence, we can't really say for sure, but reading the final part of Henry's liberty or death speech, I can't help but wonder if these last words were taken from her.
Mm.
I reckon if I was locked in a basement for 3 years in the dark with an untreated mental illness, that I would ask for liberty or death.
Right?
Preferably liberty and like SSRIs, Xanax, and a divorce. So I will end this scandal with the last paragraph of Patrick Henry's iconic speech, and you can be the judge. Gentlemen may cry, peace, peace, but there's no peace. The war is actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field. Why stand we here idle? What is it that gentlemen wish? What would they have? Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but for me, give me liberty or give me death.
Mm. That poor woman.
I know. Unmarked grave.
Yeah.
Somewhere died of who knows if she killed herself or I don't
oh,
even.
Yeah.
Someone killed her or
yeah.
we don't know. Did you know that more atheists believe in ghosts than people who are religious nowadays?
You've told me this,
yeah. I did not believe it was true until I looked into it. I'm like, people just want to believe in something.
I do have a sort of, I mean, I believe in energy.
Okay. Energy is a real thing.
I can see why atheists would want to believe in something.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people that are religious, I shouldn't get into this.
Or you should. Yeah. Take another sip and think about it. Yeah,
I
know.
I feel like the very foundations of religion are built on the idea that people need to believe that there is something more than this life.
Yeah, something more than just themselves, too. Like, the idea is a great one.
Yeah, and so I think that if you don't then believe in a god or gods, the idea that your spirit can remain and, you know, run around and look at you through paintings is sort of understandable. That, like,
yeah, that does make sense, yeah. You're less tied to, like, an orthodoxy that's rigid.
Yeah.
I really did not want to say anything about the ghosts because I don't believe in ghosts.
I mean, I think it's interesting.
Yeah,
that, like,
it is. Yeah. I think anyone knowing the story of the basement would be creeped out being down there.
It's also a basement.
Yeah.
Which is creepy regardless.
Yeah. I'm still afraid of my family home's basement.
Yeah. Paint won't adhere to the walls of a 300-year-old damp basement. Yeah.
Ghosts don't like paint. Stone.
Well, there's also that. Ghosts hate paint.
They hate it. It's like paint, spiders, the living, in that order.
Ghosts hate spiders?
Okay, maybe I'm projecting.
I think ghosts like spiders.
Oh.
They collect them. It's interesting to think about the way mental illness was handled that long ago, especially within, like, the political arena, that basically you don't have a choice but lock your wife up in the basement.
Yeah.
If you want to be a politician, she can't be running around being like, blah, 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 yeah. You know, instead she's just like,
in her straight dress, her elegant straight dress.
Yes, elegant. Well, so my story is not about ghosts.
Boo.
But it is maybe a little bit about monsters.
Okay.
These stories could not be more different, both in, like, theme and time frame.
Just information. It seems like you have a lot.
I have a lot of information.
Whereas I had a little.
I had way too much information. It took me forever to edit the story. Just this one story I'm going to tell, I could have done 3 different episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, my story today is a little bit different than the kind of thing that I normally talk about. Rather than discussing, like, one specific politician and their sort of, like, dastardly deeds.
Mm-hmm.
Today I'm going to be talking about the actions of an entire branch of government.
Oh.
And how their hubris and foolhardy carelessness had a destructive force that I can't even really begin to wrap my head around.
Okay.
Ruining innumerable lives, destroying an entire culture.
Oh.
And ultimately inspiring the Japanese sci-fi classic Godzilla.
That's the monster.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. We haven't really discussed the Cold War yet, but I would guess that most of our listeners have at least a basic understanding of what the Cold War was. But just in case you don't, the Cold War was a nuclear arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union, sparked by America's use of nuclear weapons during World War II.
We could have a whole podcast about,
I mean, just that. I want to say we could do, like, multiple episodes, but you're right. We could have an entire podcast about the Cold War. There are
With
so
many,
much
many
information.
Many seasons.
Yeah. Yeah.
There
yeah.
There's so
absolutely.
Many players. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And it lasted
for a long ass time.
A long time.
1947 all the way up until 1991.
Yeah. Fuck.
1991.
Whoa, that's insane.
It's really complicated. It's super involved. Today, just in the name of time, I'm going to massively oversimplify things. Basically, since we had nuclear weapons, or nuclear, if you're...
No.
If you're...
No.
GW. The Soviet Union basically decided to develop some of their own, kind of as an insurance policy against the United States. You bomb us, we'll bomb you kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than just calling a ceasefire or a stalemate, the U.S. in turn developed even stronger bombs so that the military could maintain their sense of superiority and act like we had the biggest swinging dick on the globe.
Yeah.
Of course, then the Soviet Union did the exact same thing, and this cycle of continual escalation lasted from 1947 up until 1991. It's way more complicated than that, but you get the idea. While we were developing these increasingly stronger and stronger nuclear weapons, the U.S. did a shitload of nuclear testing all over the globe.
Yeah.
And since it was brand new technology, and we didn't fully understand the power we had or the consequences of that power, the military didn't practice nearly as much care as they should have when conducting their tests. I could probably devote an entire season to the shadiness surrounding these nuclear tests, but today I'm going to be focusing on the testing we did in the Central Pacific, specifically in a chain of volcanic islands and coral atolls called the Marshall Islands.
Oh, okay.
They're located roughly smack dab in the middle of the ocean between Hawaii, Australia, and Southeast Asia. In the northwest of this island chain sit... Well, okay, pause here. I have to say there's a lot of names and words that I'm going to be saying today that I truly have no idea how to pronounce, so forgive me.
Yeah.
I'm going to do my best. I'm not going to just...
You're not going to do a Mayor Bloomberg? I learned this year, and I was appalled. Michael Bloomberg, when he was the mayor of New York, he had, what, 3 terms? He like, declared himself king almost. He had, like, an extra term. He used to do press conferences where he read the worst Spanish you've ever heard in your life.
He didn't speak Spanish, but he tried to read Spanish. In theory, to try and be, like, inclusive for
the... He read it so flatly, it was offensive.
Yeah.
I don't even speak Spanish, and I'm just like, oh, no, no, no. It's like he's never been in a bodega in his life. He's never right. heard it spoken in his life.
I dare you to go to YouTube and just type in Bloomberg speaking Spanish.
I really think anyone who can read English
yeah.
can read it more convincingly.
Yes. So I'm not going to be doing like, yo soy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Jesus. Gracias.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyways, yeah. So I'm going to try my best to pronounce these names correctly, but I am probably going to butcher at least a couple of them. In the northwest of this island chain sit Aniwetok Atoll and Bikini Atoll, two of the most active nuclear testing sites of the Cold War. Between 1946 and 1958, the U.S. conducted 66 nuclear weapons tests in or near these atolls, accounting for more than 50% of all the global fallout during that period.
Wow.
Unlike most of the previous fallout that was distributed widely from high-altitude testing, the majority of these tests were conducted either on the surface of the atoll lagoons, on the islands themselves, or underwater. This resulted in, quote, close-in fallout that contaminated the local islands and lagoon sediments, as well as larger areas of the North Pacific Ocean. Yeah.
They did this in the water?
Yeah. A lot of just blowing up the water. They thought that they were so far away from land masses that it would be fine.
No, that's not. Yeah. No. That's not how ecology works.
Yeah. The second ever test in this area, codenamed Baker, was an underwater explosion that was suspended under a barge. It produced a huge vapor cloud and contaminated 57 military ships, 8 of which either sunk or capsized after the explosion. In an attempt to decontaminate the remaining ships, Navy sailors were told to scrub the decks or spray them with water.
Oh, yes, water.
Yeah.
Water will fix everything. Yeah.
Directly exposing.
Wait, okay, let me stop.
Yeah.
Was there, like, no scientists involved? They really thought water was going to remove radiation? Water?
Yeah. The further I go in this, you're going to learn just how little they understood about,
I am not a scientist, but that is stupid.
Yeah. They just didn't get it. They didn't know what, they didn't know what to expect. They didn't understand the power that they had.
Yeah.
And they didn't understand what the consequences would
be. Too many fucking men.
Yeah.
Just blowing shit up.
Exactly.
Being like, this is fun.
It's literally a pissing contest.
Yeah. Ugh.
With insanely grave consequences.
I feel like if there was just at least 3 women, they'd be like, wait, what are we...
Why are we doing this? Yeah.
Wait.
Yeah.
No.
So in an attempt to decontaminate the remaining ships, Navy sailors were told to scrub the decks or spray them with water, directly exposing themselves to dangerous levels of radiation. The decontamination efforts didn't work. Surprise.
What?
And most of the ships were considered too hot to handle. So they were just sunk in the lagoon, where they remain to this day.
Oh, no.
Chemist Glenn Seaborg, the longest-serving chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, called the Baker test, quote, the world's first nuclear disaster.
Definitely.
First of many. So the next series of tests in 1954 was codenamed Operation Castle, The first detonation, Castle Bravo, was the first ever test of an air-deliverable dry-fuel thermonuclear hydrogen bomb. Hydrogen bombs were much, well, are much stronger than the atomic bombs we've been using before. But up until this point, they were also much too large to carry in and drop from a military aircraft. So this was the first ever air-deliverable hydrogen bomb. Castle Bravo was detonated at dawn on March 1st, 1954. Due to a design error, the explosion reached a yield of 15 megatons, making it 2.5 times larger than scientists expected, and 1,000 times more powerful than either of the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima or Nagasaki during World War II. Wow. 1,000 times more powerful. 1 megaton is equivalent to 1 million tons of TNT.
Yeah.
Scientists and military authorities were shocked by the size of the explosion, and many of the instruments that they had put in place to evaluate the effectiveness of the bomb were completely destroyed.
I mean, duh. 1,000 times more powerful? Yeah, goodbye.
So this just goes to show how little the people who designed these bombs really understood their destructive force.
Yeah, we don't have money for, like, poor people. Okay.
Well, this, I will say, this was in the 50s when there was a middle class, because we had a 90% marginal tax rate in the 1950s. But that's for another episode. So the detonation created a fireball that was 4 miles wide. 4 miles wide. And raised the temperature of the lagoon water to 99,000 degrees. It completely vaporized.
I was about to say, how is there still water at that point?
There was not.
Okay, yeah. I'm like, that's vapor.
Yeah.
Like hot-ass vapor. Vapor that burns anything in the sky.
Yes. It completely vaporized 3 islands in Bikini Atoll.
Okay.
And killed every single living thing in the air, land, and sea 4 miles around.
Course. Yeah.
Aerial photos of Bikini Atoll today show the greatest physical scar ever left by any of these nuclear tests. Where there was once islands and reef, there is now a gaping underwater crater 1 mile wide and 200 feet deep.
Wow.
The explosion sent millions of tons of burned sand, coral, plant, and sea life miles up into the air. The fact that the bomb was way more powerful than expected was not the only problem with their test that day either. The other issue was that before the test was conducted, the wind had changed direction, unexpectedly. Instead of carrying all the bomb's radioactive fallout over open ocean, it carried it over some of the inhabited atolls of the Marshall Islands. 3 or 4 hours after the blast, the 82 inhabitants of neighboring Rongelap and Elingene atolls, who had never been informed about the test, watched in wonder as highly radioactive snow-like calcinated coral ash began to fall from the sky, reaching a depth of about 2 inches.
Oh.
Not knowing what it was or where it came from, children played in it.
Of course they did.
People tasted it.
What?
And they drank water saturated with it.
Oh, okay.
Soon, they began to experience severe vomiting and diarrhea. Their eyes burned, their necks, arms, and legs swelled, and the islanders fell into a panic. 2 or 3 days later, the military servicemen showed up and forced
hey, how are you guys feeling?
Yeah, yeah. They forced the islanders to move to neighboring Kwajalein Atoll for medical care, and they were not allowed to return to their island, their native land, for 3 years.
Oh.
But shortly after their return, they were forced to relocate again because radiation levels on the island were found to be unsafe.
Of course they were.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how scientists didn't understand, like, half-lives of isotopes and stuff, but they didn't know that fallout was going
to... forever and ever.
Yeah.
And ever.
Yeah. So the fallout levels attributed to the Castle Bravo test are the highest in history. Almost all of the islanders suffered from acute radiation syndrome, and several weeks later, many people started to lose their hair and experience burning skin lesions.
Mm.
As Stephanie takes a sip, I say, burning skin lesions.
Ugh, sad.
Sorry. 6 days after the test, the U.S. government set up a secret project to study the medical effects of fallout on the residents of the Marshall Islands, but they were later accused of using the inhabitants as medical research subjects without their consent. Up until that point, the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission had given almost no thought to the potential impact of widespread fallout contamination beyond the formally designated boundary of their test site. The islanders' exposure to fallout has been linked to increased likelihood of birth defects and thyroid disease, as well as several types of cancer, such as leukemia, oral cancer, gastrointestinal cancer, and thyroid cancer. The female population of the Marshall Islands have a 60 times greater mortality rate from cervical cancer than a comparable mainland United States population.
Wow.
In later tests under Operation Castle, the military decided...
How many people live there?
It's only 82 in these two atolls, but the Marshall Islands had a lot more than that, but these two were the ones that were most affected just during Castle Bravo.
Okay.
But then there was a lot more testing after Castle Bravo.
I wonder where were the Russians testing all their shit?
I know of at least one explosion or one test that was done really far north of Russia in, like, not quite the Arctic,
like,
but...
like Siberia?
Yeah, off the coast on some Siberian sort of, like, island.
Wow, so they were doing it really... I mean, Siberia is huge, but still, they were doing it near them.
I don't even know if it's Siberia. It's, like, off the coast, the northern coast of Russia. Oh. They may have been using other sites as well that I'm not aware of.
It sounds like they didn't know shit about shit.
This is how they learned.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this it's fucked up. Yeah. We didn't need to know this information.
No.
In later tests under Operation Castle, the military decided to relocate other inhabitants in the Marshall Islands in advance, fearing that they might also be affected by fallout. They promised these islanders that they would be allowed to return to their native homes when testing was over. In a closed session of the Congressional Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, Congressman James Van Zandt joked, "The natives ought to benefit. They got a couple good baths." Fucking...
terrible.
Yeah.
Why don't you bathe your family in that?
The first of many problems was that the islands where they were relocated were too small to sustain life, and the islanders were later found starving to death and had to be relocated 5 times over the next several decades.
I don't know why they just didn't bring them to the U.S. It's the least they
could
do.
I think they didn't want... These people had been living on these islands for thousands of years. They wanted to maintain this sort of, like...
indigenous people.
Yes.
Okay, so you can't just drop them in Chicago.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Two atolls had 82 people.
Yeah, but they had been there for a really long time.
For thousands of years.
Damn!
Yeah.
Well, that's upsetting.
The next problem was that the effects of fallout contamination lasted much, much longer than they originally thought. And despite the promises made to these islanders... Bikini has been rendered completely unfit for human habitation even to this day.
Yeah.
Almost none of the descendants of the Marshallese have ever visited the islands that they're originally from, and they would have no idea how to make a life there even if they wanted to return. Councilwoman Lainey Kramer said, "As a result of being displaced, we have lost our cultural heritage, our traditional customs and skills, which for thousands of years were passed down from generation to generation."
Wow. Thousands of years.
Yeah.
It's like, we Americans don't really understand what that even means, because we've been here for 300 plus years.
Yeah.
Like, thousands, plural thousands of years of culture. I don't even know what that looks like. I only know 300 years of culture.
And even Americans today don't even care about our 300 years of culture.
No.
People are like... that's old. I don't care. Who cares? Ugh,
the Alamo. Boring.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of was, but...
I mean, things that happened less than 100 years ago. We're talking about, like, 1930s.
Yeah.
Fascism and stuff, and people are like, what?
I know.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, they think it's socialism or communism.
Yeah. So here's the thing, though. If it had just been a couple hundred Native Islanders who were exposed to this fallout, I probably would not be telling you this story today, because... we wouldn't know about it.
Yeah.
The Atomic Energy Commission probably would have kept things under wrap even after the Castle Bravo test went wrong, but the Marshallese were not the only community affected by these tests. So Castle Bravo was thrust into the international spotlight thanks to a Japanese fishing boat that drifted into the test fallout plume and returned home horribly sick with a cargo full of radioactive tuna.
Oh, no.
What could have been a hush-hush operation quickly transformed into a major diplomatic incident between Japan, who once again had the good fortune of being irradiated by the United States military, and the United States, who suddenly had their secret operation exposed to the public eye. Almost immediately, the U.S. was, for the first time, admitting that they had the ability to make multi-megaton weapons and being compelled to release information about long-distance, long-term fallout contamination. On February 9th, just a few weeks before the Castle Bravo test, a small Japanese fishing boat, ironically named the Lucky Dragon, number 5, was somewhere south of Midway Island when about half of their 330 fishing lines and trawl nets were snagged on some coral reefs and lost.
Okay.
The fishermen had the option to either return home in disgrace after catching only a handful of big eye tuna, or to keep searching for more with only half of their lines. The captain decided to head south towards what he hoped would be the richer waters near the Marshall Islands. By March 1st, the boat and its 23 young crew members were about 60 to 80 miles from the test site at Bikini Atoll, outside of the U.S. government's danger zone. At 6:45 a.m., the sky was still dark, but lit up suddenly. The sound of the blast reached them about 7 minutes later. One crew member said, "I remember the brilliant flash in the west, the frightening sound that followed, and the extraordinary sky, which turned red as far as I could see."
Scary.
In his 2011 book, The Day the Sun Rose in the West, Matakichi Oishi details a firsthand account of what happened to he and his fellow crew members. "A yellow flash poured through the porthole. Wondering what had happened, I jumped up from the bunk near the door, ran out on deck, and was astonished. Bridge, sky, and sea burst into view, painted in flaming sunset colors. The top of the clouds spread over us. 2 hours passed. White particles were falling on us, just like sleet.
No.
The white particles penetrated mercilessly. Eyes, nose, ears, mouth. We had no sense that it was dangerous." These men had no idea that they'd just witnessed the largest man-made explosion in history, but they did know something was very wrong, and they needed to get the fuck out of there.
Yeah.
Before setting a course for home, though, they spent the next 6 hours pulling in all of their lines and nets, with fallout drifting down on them like snow for the first 3 of those hours.
Wow.
Not knowing what on earth it was that was falling from the sky, these men scooped up this highly radioactive ash into bags with their bare hands. Oishi reported that he took a lick.
Oh, why?
Describing it as
this?
Gritty, but with no taste. They didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
They had no concept of what, like, zero clue. Shit, like, white things are falling from the sky,
yeah,
and you don't know why.
I would think, like, it can't be good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we also live in a very different world than these,
we
like,
do.
Japanese
yeah.
fishermen in yeah. 1954.
I'm not blaming them for being
yeah.
curious.
Yeah.
Because, yeah.
So by that evening, they were already starting to notice skin burns and other symptoms of radiation sickness.
Yeah.
Symptoms that would only get worse during their 2-week-long voyage back to Japan.
It took them 2 weeks?
They were way out. And they're in this, like, dinky little fishing boat that's,
yeah.
like, old and beat up. Yeah. They started to refer to the dust all over their boat and their bodies as Shinohai, or ashes of death. Later tests confirmed that it was made up of a toxic cocktail of radioactive isotopes. The ship reached Yaizu, Japan on March 14th, and still not realizing what had happened or why the Shinohai was making them sick, they unloaded their cargo of tuna and sent it off to the busy fish markets of Tokyo. From there, they finally went to seek medical attention. The crew members were quarantined in a hospital outside of Yaizu, and scientists traveled from all over Japan to come examine them in their boat. A Geiger counter detected radiation as far as 100 feet from the Lucky Dragon, so the ship was towed to a remote section of the port and put under police guard. The crew members were quickly diagnosed with acute radiation syndrome, their heads were shaved, and their irradiated clothing and possessions were buried. Some of the scientists wrote letters to the chief of the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission asking for more information on how to treat the crew, who were suffering from nausea, headaches, pain in the eyes, bleeding from the gums, burned skin, and other symptoms. The U.S. didn't respond to the letter, but they did dispatch 2 medical scientists of their own to assist the doctors and study the effects of fallout on the crew. In a frantic effort to track down the Lucky Dragon's catch, Geiger counters were also taken to Tokyo's fish markets to help locate each one of the huge tunas they'd unloaded, but at least 2 of them had already been sold and likely eaten.
How terrible.
Again, it's like, why would you send these fucking tuna when you're clearly, like, something is making you sick on this boat? But they didn't know.
They didn't know.
They didn't understand what was happening. Maybe they thought it was a disease, but why would you think a fish could be affected by that? So after the U.S. retroactively expanded the boundaries of the test site's danger zone, the Japanese Ministry of Health and Welfare stated that 856 other fishing vessels with upwards of 20,000 crew members had also been exposed to radiation from the Castle Bravo test. The price of tuna subsequently plunged due to fears over radiation, and some 75 tons caught from March through December of 1954 were found to be unfit for human consumption and destroyed.
Okay.
The FDA later imposed rigid restrictions on tuna imports to the United States. Additional testing and monitoring revealed that the radioactive fallout from the test was transported westward by prevailing air and ocean currents, and increased radiation levels were found not only in seafood, but in Japan's rice, vegetables, and produce.
Of course.
A little over 6 months later, on September 3rd, the chief radio operator of the ship, Akichi Kuboyama, died, leaving behind a wife and three young daughters. 15 other crew members later died of cancer and other causes related to their radiation exposure, and most medical professionals believe that all the men were also infected with hepatitis C through blood transfusions during their treatment.
Wait, what?
They were in the hospital and they were given blood transfusions thinking that it might help the radiation sickness. I don't think people really understood.
Maybe they didn't test for that back then.
I don't think they even really understood it.
Yeah.
Every one of them was given hepatitis C.
Like they need anything more than what they have.
Much like the survivors of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings in 1945, the Lucky Dragon's crew were stigmatized because many Japanese people had an irrational fear of those exposed to radiation and believed that it might be contagious.
Oh, okay.
The crew tried to keep their exposure a secret, and many of them even moved far away from their homes to try and make a fresh start. Kuboyama's death sparked an international incident and reignited Japanese concerns about radiation, giving rise to a fierce anti-nuclear movement and calls for a ban on atmospheric testing of thermonuclear devices. When Edward Teller, nicknamed the father of the hydrogen bomb, learned of Kuboyama's death and the outrage it sparked, he said, "It's unreasonable to make such a big deal over the death of a fisherman."
What a shitty person.
Wow. Dude, fuck you.
And like, Japan needs even more things, like nuclear related things to happen to them from the US.
And it's like 1945 to 1954, so less than 10 years since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. 9 years later.
That's no time. Wow.
The head of the Atomic Energy Commission issued a series of denials about the incident.
What? They tried to deny it?
Deny like certain parts of it, yeah. They even told President Eisenhower's press secretary that the Lucky Dragon may have been, quote, a red spy outfit commanded by a Soviet agent, intentionally exposing the ship's crew and their tuna catch to embarrass the United States and gain intelligence on the weapons being tested in the area.
That is stupid and doesn't make sense at all. It's so thinly veiled.
When a Polish physicist determined that the contamination caused by the fallout was far greater than the U.S. officially stated, the media took up his paper and the outcry in Japan reached such a level that the incident was dubbed a second Hiroshima, causing a huge strain on Japan's diplomatic relationship with the United States. The two governments quickly reached a political settlement with a transfer to Japan of $15.3 million in compensation, with the surviving victims each receiving about 2 million yen, which was equivalent to about $5,500 in 1954, or about $52,000 in 2019.
That's no money.
No money.
That's
clearly not
dollars.
Enough. Not enough.
Yeah, not even close.
$50,000 to be like irradiated and have to leave your life because people are thinking that you're gonna infect them somehow, and then you might die. 15 of these 23 men died from cancer.
Yeah, you're not gonna live a long life after that.
And you get $50,000.
Yeah.
So the Lucky Dragon incident and the fear and anxiety it instilled in the Japanese people also happened to directly inspire the original Japanese sci-fi horror movie Godzilla.
Okay.
With the Lucky Dragon incident happening less than a decade after the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Godzilla was basically conceived as a metaphor for the dangerous power of nuclear weapons, and the movie was released only 8 months after Castle Bravo on November 3rd, 1954. It's about a giant prehistoric sea monster who is awakened and given radioactive power by nuclear testing in the Pacific, and then goes on to violently attack Japan.
I did not know. I've never seen the movie.
I'm going to get into this a little bit more in a second. But there's a lot of different versions of this movie because it was so popular. I had seen a version of it.
Yeah.
And I assumed that it was original because it was really old and it was Japanese and it was dubbed. But I hadn't seen it either.
Oh, okay.
The original.
The original.
Yeah. While the monster was designed to look a bit like a dinosaur, it's sort of like craggy, scabby skin texture was actually inspired by the keloid scars seen on survivors of Hiroshima.
That's terrible.
Yeah. For research, I decided to watch the original Godzilla.
Okay.
Which I I thought I'd already seen, but there have been approximately 300,000 reboots. There's a lot.
More
There's
than Ernest a movies? Lot.
Or Madea's.
Yes.
There's more than Ernest and Madea combined.
Oh! Scary.
The original movie, it feels really different from the other Godzilla movies that I've seen, and it felt really different from what I was expecting. The original movie opens on the crew of a Japanese fishing boat witnessing a bright flash of light and an explosion out in the ocean. Even the trailer for this movie is crystal clear about the movie's message. A giant monster from the Jurassic period, born of the H-bomb. Emitting radiation and breathing fire, Godzilla has come to destroy Tokyo. A giant monster from 2 million years ago is roused from its undersea lair by H-bomb testing, the terror of our age.
It is the terror of their age.
There is absolutely nothing subtle about what the movie says brought Godzilla to life and why Japan is in danger. Rather than being a big splashy disaster movie, it actually felt really somber, almost sad rather than scary.
I mean, it is sad.
Yeah, but I just, like, knowing what Godzilla means today and what Godzilla is today, it was not what I was expecting to watch. Mm. I thought it was going to be really corny because it's from the 50s and I was just expecting a lot of really bad special effects, which there are.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But it's not really the focus of the movie at all. They spent more time focusing on the fear and emotional devastation of the Japanese people than on the actual destruction caused by the monster. Since Godzilla was empowered by a hydrogen bomb, the only way to destroy it would be to create a weapon even more dangerous and powerful than a hydrogen bomb. The scientist who ultimately creates it is so torn about the possibility of his weapon falling into the wrong hands or being used for war that he burns all of his notes after creating it. And then he actually kills himself when he kills the monster so that he would never be tempted to create another weapon like it.
Oh, that sounds very Japanese.
Yeah.
They're such conscientious people.
Yeah. But culturally, I think also because they were, at this point, the only country who had experienced the horrors of nuclear fallout
three times at this point. Yeah.
It just goes to show, like, the weight of that and the idea that they didn't want this to be
a thing that kept happening.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. At the very end of the movie, after Godzilla is finally dead, another scientist gives a speech about the dangers of continued nuclear testing. It didn't take American filmmakers long to take notice and decide that they wanted to release it in the United States too, but not before giving it the old red, white, and blue treatment. They shot additional scenes with an American actor playing a reporter witnessing the destruction, and then sort of cut his scenes into the original footage, spinning it as being seen through his eyes. But they didn't even really dub it. They just sort of have him, like, talking about what's going on. Because the rest of it didn't have subtitles, so it was kind of just like this American guy being like, this is what they're talking about.
Oh, I see, okay.
They cut most of the really somber scenes, like one where a mother is praying with her children and waiting for their imminent death, or another of a church filled with young women singing for the safety of Japan's future.
Yeah.
They also cut the original anti-nuclear warning speech at the end of the film and replaced it with a happy ending speech by the American actor instead.
That is such an American thing to do. We love happy endings.
Oh, us.
We're children in a lot of ways. We're not prepared for heavy truths.
Yeah.
Just like, no, no, no.
Thankfully, in less than a decade, the United States and the Soviet Union finally agreed on a test ban treaty in 1963. Unfortunately, there was plenty of foot dragging the years in between, giving Khrushchev a chance to test the largest weapon ever detonated on the planet in 1961.
What?
The Tsar Bomba, which came in at a whopping 50 megatons compared to Castle Bravo's 15.
50?
50.
Damn.
It destroyed homes in Soviet districts hundreds of miles from the blast zone, and windows were shattered in coastal Finland, 560 miles away. That's about from here to Toledo.
Damn! They did this, like, on the ground or in the water?
It was, I think they dropped it from a plane, but off...
off the coast.
Off the coast, north of...
That's why I got Finland and...
Yeah.
Whoa.
Anyways, we did finally come to an agreement to ban nuclear testing in 1963. The treaty was signed by the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, and the United States in Moscow on August 5th.
Wait, was the UK doing tests as well? Or they just wanted to be part?
Something came up in my research that makes me think they might have done a couple, but I didn't really investigate that any further, so...
I would assume so if they're signing this treaty.
Yeah. Well, then there was a lot of countries that also signed it,
saying, like, I'm never going to do this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the three that signed it initially, it was signed in Moscow on August 5th, but it didn't formally go into effect until October 10th.
Okay.
Because it was being signed by all these other countries. Unfortunately, the treaty does not stop anyone from actually building nuclear weapons. They just can't test them. But it did coincide with a substantial decline in the concentration of radioactive particles in the atmosphere. So, lucky for us, we don't have to worry about the possibility of exposure to fallout unless we take a trip to the Marshall Islands.
Yeah, or Japan.
I think at this point, because the radiation that was like getting into their rice and stuff, it was mostly...
I'm talking about Fukushima.
Oh, yeah. Oh, damn. I forgot about that.
Yeah. Moving on.
I know. Well, there's plenty of other things that could...
Yeah. Have you seen...
Chernobyl? I haven't seen it. Tim read this and was like, you have to watch Chernobyl.
I was told by my cousin, my German cousin, that I need to watch it. I hear it's really, really dark.
Yeah.
But like, just very real.
We need these real dark stories
yeah.
to sort of snap us into reality.
It's so bad that the Russian government, they're trying to make their own Chernobyl to counter the truth that we've exposed. It's like everyone has known what's happened, but we just didn't know.
Yeah, Chernobyl's like old news at this point.
But they're going to make their own version that's, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
My research on this story brought me to a lot of...
Ghost stories?
Ooh. No, mansplainy bullshit. About the necessary evils of nuclear proliferation for national security purposes. But it seems that very few of those people ever considered the price the world had to pay so that Eisenhower and Khrushchev could play army man.
Yeah.
I also have to say... that the idea that there is technology out there to create a 50-plus megaton bomb that could destroy homes for hundreds and hundreds of miles freaks me the fuck out.
It's scary.
I've spent more sleepless nights than I would care to admit thinking about everything I've read in researching this story.
Yeah.
And I've also been doing quite a bit of light Googling.
Bomb shelters?
Well, about the best way to ride out the aftermath of a nuclear detonation.
Oh.
If we survive the initial explosion, how to then ride out the fallout that happens aftermath. Yeah. Don't drive away. Cars provide almost no protection from fallout.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah, as if I wasn't enough fun at parties already.
Yeah, I know. You're the funnest.
Yes. That's it.
Okay, now I'm scared about the apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
These weapons still exist. I don't think anyone is crazy enough, but I shouldn't say that because there's plenty of crazy people, but...
That there are.
It is mad, literally. Mutually assured destruction. Yeah. That anyone would use this, it's like, you're killing everyone. It's game over.
It's insane. It doesn't make any fucking sense, but like, just the possibility that somebody else could... is why all these other countries then want to try and develop their weapons too.
I think the most active border is India-Pakistan.
Yeah.
For that sort of possibility. I don't think anyone's crazy enough to do it.
Just fucking call a stalemate. Call a ceasefire. Yes, we know that we can do this. You can do it. Yeah. You know that I can do it. But
we all want to live.
Let's just fucking stop it. It's madness. It's madness.
Yeah, it's so crazy. But that was really good. Thank you.
Yeah.
That was really terrifying. And
terrifying.
Like, real terrifying as opposed to a ghost story that I told. That was just nonsense. I choose to live in a world where no one is that crazy.
Let's hope that that world exists for a very long time.
Yes. Thank you for listening to Beyond Reproach.
Yes,
this has been
you.
Stephanie Domingo.
And Tux Lurzel.
Thank you to Tim Clough, our editor, sound engineer, and podfather. We could not do this without him at all.
Not at all.
Please rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you'd like to help us, please share with the class. Tell a friend. Beyond Reproach Pod on Facebook, Insta, Twitter. We also have a Patreon if anyone would like to show us some love and support the production of our show.
America's history is juicy.
Yes.
We just add hot brown beer with eggs and molasses in it.
Yes. Don't forget the nutmeg.
Toodaloo. Bye.